that many traffic accidents are the result of drivers on their cell phones. Whether you're talking or texting, cell phone usage while driving has become a serious problem. DWC Tax and Financial Services asks you to do your part to keep the streets safe. That's DWC Tax and Financial Services, 414-975-5397.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, the author of a brand new book called American Injustice. In part two, from the archives, a conversation by the co-authors of a powerful novel called Justice for None. One of those co-authors, award-winning actor Gene Hackman. Here's part one of today's program. We're spending this portion of WGTD's morning show with one of the most renowned trial lawyers in the country. His name is David S. Rudolph. And he is someone who has extensive experience in the law, in the courtroom, and also in the classroom. And you may know him for his appearance in the Netflix documentary, The Staircase, which is soon to see new life as a dramatic series on HBO Max. And he also co-hosts an award-winning podcast called Abuse of Power. He has written a new book called American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. In this hard-hitting book, David S. Rudolph paints a disconcerting picture of the criminal justice system and the way in which it ill-serves wide swaths of the American population, and that in particular we see so many people who are innocent of the crimes of which they are charged being in many cases convicted and wrongfully incarcerated. He has spent years and large amounts of his energy and resources in defending the wrongfully accused. And it is out of that experience that he writes his new book, published by Custom House, again titled American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. David S. Rudolph, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being able to talk with you.
Explain to our listeners sort of your personal journey in terms of the journey from your education to when it came time to sort of decide where you would focus your energies professionally, why you ultimately took the path that you did.
Well, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and so in college I was exposed to Kent State. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In college, I was exposed to the Kent State situation. And, of course, in law school, we had Watergate. When I graduated from law school, I decided I was going to become a public defender, which is what I did in the South Bronx. I did that for several years. I then became a federal defender in Brooklyn. And then I went to teach for 4 years, and that wasn't satisfying enough for me, so I went back into the courtroom. And over the years, I represented a number of people, both well-known and well-off, and those who are poor. Over those years, I learned a lot about how the abuses of power in the criminal justice system can affect both the wealthy and the poor alike. It really was the Peterson case, the case that was in the staircase, that finally made me realize that I needed to start focusing on wrongful convictions, because I felt strongly that he had been wrongfully convicted. That led me to begin focusing on people who had been wrongfully charged, convicted, and ultimately exonerated. And that's really what I focused on for the last 15 or so years. And then, of course, the Netflix series bolted that whole situation into a publicity tour and a speaking tour. And I realized that what I really wanted to do was speak to more than 12 people at a time in a jury box. I wanted to speak to as many people as I could about what I had seen over my career. And so here we are.
One of the things you seek to do in your book, particularly in the first portion of the book, is to help all of us understand better the role of the criminal defense lawyer. And interestingly enough, that section of the book begins with a story out of our own country's history way back in the fall of 1768. Explain briefly the nature of this story that you tell in this portion of the book and why it's here. Why it's important for this exploration of the work of defense attorneys to begin with this particular story and this important early American.
Well, you know, it was during the time of the Revolution, obviously, and there was a shooting by British troops in Boston. It came to be known as the Boston Massacre. And obviously, the citizens of Boston were up in arms very upset. The soldiers were charged with murder, and no one wanted to defend them because it was, to say the least, an extremely unpopular cause to defend them. And lawyers were afraid of losing their livelihood if they defended them. But one young lawyer in Boston decided that he believed in the rule of law and in the need to represent people regardless of what they were charged with. And so he took the case on, and he actually won acquittals for most of them. Some of them were convicted of manslaughter. He went on to do other things in his life, but in his later years said it was the most satisfying and courageous thing he had ever done. And that young lawyer's name was John Adams. And John Adams went on to sign the Declaration of Independence. He went on to be the Vice President of the United States and eventually the President of the United States. And so it's a really interesting story about how important the rule of law and criminal defense lawyers are to the entire history of our country. It's really foundational, and I just thought it was important for those people who don't know the story to understand that in evaluating what we as criminal defense lawyers do on a daily basis.
Right. And of course, the work that you do often raises a question that people have certainly heard often enough, and probably most of us have at some point or another kind of raised this question: how can you possibly represent somebody like that? And how can you look at yourself in the mirror in good conscience, knowing that you are defending somebody who we assume or fear have done something really, really terrible? And your answer to that question, which you explore in your book, has to do with recognizing the humanity of your clients, no matter what it is that they may have done. Take us inside those words. What does it mean for you as a defense attorney to recognize the humanity of a client who has perhaps been accused of something really terrible?
Well, you know, to start with, I need to recognize the humanity if I'm going to express that and show that to other people like the judges and the prosecutors. You know, what it really means is that none of us want to be judged by the very worst thing we have ever done in our lives. So it is very important in the criminal justice system for defense lawyers to put the conduct of their clients into context to the extent one can. So there's a sort of misunderstanding that somehow people think that our job as criminal defense lawyers is to, quote, get people off with technicalities. That is, it couldn't be further from the truth. That's not our job. Our job is certainly to protect the rule of law and people's rights. But the vast majority of cases, and let's not just assume the person is guilty. Let's say he is guilty. In that situation, what you're doing is you're talking to the prosecutor about what's the context. What, you know, how to, if the person has a criminal history, what in his background led him to that? What experiences did he have that caused him to be who he is? Or alternatively, if this is a momentary thing, then we need to explain that and explain the circumstances. And point out all the good things that the person has done in their life. So, you know, that's the job of the criminal defense lawyer. And it's interesting because no one questions the emergency room physician or the surgeon who treats somebody who has just committed some awful crime and has been shot by the police, for example. He's brought into the emergency room. He's brought into the operating theater. And doctors do what they're trained to do because that's their role. Well, no one criticizes them, but yet somehow, even though we're doing exactly the same thing, we get criticized for doing that. And I think there's just a fundamental misunderstanding about what our role is. And hopefully the book will help people to see that. And in particular, you know, the story of John Rook in the book is really meant to illustrate that nothing is black and white in life.
Absolutely. And I do appreciate the way in which you tell that really moving story. We're speaking with David S. Rudolph, author of American Injustice. I feel like your book is also so valuable in the way that it helps us understand this whole notion of due process and the circumstances under which due process became at least the way things are supposed to work in this country. You tell us that much of what we think of now in terms of due process in our criminal justice system emerged during that turbulent period of the 60s and 70s when our nation saw, of course, so much cultural and societal upheaval. And a lot of us don't stop to appreciate the way in which our criminal justice system was quite radically transformed during those particular years. Just summarize briefly the most important ways in which our criminal justice system saw really significant change during those years?
Well, you know, everyone these days assumes that everybody has a right to a lawyer and the police have to give people an explanation of their rights and the state has to fund a lawyer if somebody is incarcerated, is indigent. And, you know, none of that existed prior to the 1950s. It was really in the 1950s and 60s that the Warren Court, led by Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was appointed by a Republican and was a Republican himself, led a real revolution. And the basis of it was that the federal Constitution, the Due Process Clause of the federal Constitution, applied to the states. And so the states had to abide by the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution. And that was the key that opened up all of the procedures that all of us take for granted today. It really was quite a revolution. I didn't realize it. You know, when I was in law school in the 70s, this was all happening. And I sort of took it as, well, in the natural progression of things, but it wasn't at all the natural progression of things. It was quite a revolutionary time in our jurisprudence, and I've come to appreciate that much more now. And I thought it was important in the book for people to understand that all of these rights that we currently have in the criminal justice system are not ancient. They're really in the last 50 or so years that they were formed. And they can disappear just as quickly as they were formed.
That's actually a really good point that hadn't really occurred to me. The fact that they are so new also, in a sense, makes them, well, the first word that comes to mind is fragile, or maybe
right.
not necessarily fully permanent. and they are rights that need to be zealously safeguarded, because as you just said, they could very easily go away.
Well, and indeed, all you need to look at is what's happening with Roe versus Wade. You know, that's been the law for 50 years. It's by no means clear that it's going to remain the law after this year. So, you know, all of these rights are fragile, as you put it, and we need to really do our best to safeguard them and to safeguard the rule of law, which has been under attack for at least the last 5 years, if not longer.
Hmm. Much of your book, of course, is focused on what we might kind of characterize as the miscarriage of justice, in terms of people who are wrongfully accused of committing a crime, in many cases wrongfully convicted, wrongfully incarcerated, and of course you have worked as a defense attorney in many cases to try to right those kind of situations. Ahead of us kind of talking about some of this wrongdoing that you have seen firsthand, I wonder if you could just say a word about what strikes me as one potential pitfall of writing a book like this, namely the fact that one might read a book like this and have a sense that the entire system is entirely corrupt, and one might really lose all faith in the criminal justice system. And in the same way that when one attacks what they see as problems with, for instance, the press or other major institutions, that undermining the public's trust in those systems and institutions can have very serious consequences. Do you have any concerns about that, or did you have any concerns about that as you wrote this book and as you characterized what you obviously believe is a very, very serious and widespread problem?
Well, actually, I think that it's important to educate people about the problems, and I think I went out of my way in the book, certainly I meant to not just indict the entire system or everybody who operates in the system. You know, I think I pointed out that I'm not saying that police are corrupt or that they're trying to set up or frame innocent people. That's not the situation at all. What happens is that police and prosecutors and judges and all of us, you and I and everybody listening, we all suffer from confirmation bias. It's a human condition. And once we, you know, sort of set on a theory in our minds, the consequence of that is that we tend to focus in on those facts that support our theory, and we tend to ignore the facts that are contradictory to our theory. And that's something that happens in every field of endeavor. You know, doctors have to go through a differential diagnosis and rule out various causes of a particular disease before they reach a diagnosis. And that's essentially to combat confirmation bias. But that's what happens in the vast, vast majority of these cases. You know, the police come on a scene. They have experience. They have intuition. 95% of the time, or perhaps more, they're right. But when they're wrong, confirmation bias kicks in, and they ignore those facts that are inconsistent with their theory. And that's where things really go off the rail.
Hmm.
So it's not that the system is corrupt. It's that it's human. And we need to recognize that. And we need to take steps to try to combat that. You know, just like in medical education, people learn how to do differential diagnosis to combat that. And, you know, pilots go through checklists before they take off. So, too, I think police and prosecutors need to recognize that confirmation bias is a human problem. And we all need to take steps to try to be aware of it and to keep it in check.
Right. Very well said. I was introduced to a term in your book, in your book's introduction, actually, that I don't remember seeing or hearing before, something called noble cause corruption. And you sort of lay this out as probably being the predominant cause for the kind of misconduct that your book explores. Explain this term, noble cause corruption, and the way in which we typically see this play out.
Sure. And interestingly enough, it's in those cases where the evidence of guilt is weakest that we see noble cause corruption most often. And here's why. When we talk about noble cause corruption, what we're really talking about is a mindset that the ends justify the means. And so the police decide that so-and-so is the perpetrator. But the evidence is really thin. And maybe there's even exculpatory evidence that would tend to allow the person to interview, quote, get off. Of course, if the person's innocent, he's not or she's not getting off. But that's the police view because of confirmation bias. And so now in those cases where the evidence is really weak, what do the police do? They believe that they don't want this person to, who's the perpetrator, to get off. So perhaps, for example, in the case of Brendan Dassey, they conduct a interrogation that is completely improper and leading and takes advantage of a young person's, you know, intellectual disabilities. And they get a confession, which is, you know, sort of on its face incredible. And they use that to indict the person. That's a good example of noble cause corruption. I don't think those police officers thought that Brendan Dassey didn't know anything. They thought he knew something, and so they were going to get him to say it. And that happens all the time. It happens in false confessions. It happens with forensic science when, experts come in and stretch the truth or stretch the science beyond recognition. It happens in cases where police sometimes plant evidence, as I believe happened in Making a Murderer with regard to the keys to the car or the truck. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about noble cause corruption. And I think it is at the root of many of the problems that we see.
Another factor in this that you explore to some extent is characterized by a much more common term, that of tunnel vision. That is when there is this sort of focus on one possibility to the exclusion of all others, and often leading to really terrible and harmful mistakes being made. Explain how most commonly, or maybe most seriously, we see this phenomenon of tunnel vision, and at what level of the criminal justice system is that the most serious kind of problem?
Well, first of all, tunnel vision is really a direct result of confirmation bias. As a result of confirmation bias, you develop tunnel vision. Two go hand in hand. If you're asking me at what level of the criminal justice system is that a problem, the answer is at every level. At every level. You know, the police have tunnel vision once they sit on a theory. The prosecutors have tunnel vision once the police bring them a case. The judges have tunnel vision once the prosecutors indict somebody and bring them to trial. The appellate judges have tunnel vision once they're reviewing a case. And frankly, defense lawyers have tunnel vision when they're defending a case. I have suffered from that. I'm not immune to that particular problem. In the Staircase documentary, there was evidence the so-called owl theory that I just ignored because it didn't. I couldn't imagine how certain things happened. You know, how did feathers get in her hair? How was there a twig on the staircase behind her body? These things didn't make any sense to me, and so I ignored them or invented explanations that satisfied me, but in retrospect may not have been accurate. So that's an example of even a defense lawyer suffering from tunnel vision. None of us are immune from it.
Right. And, of course, if we're talking about a particular place where there is this culture in place, then this kind of misstep can occur again and again and again. One of the most chilling sections of the book is when you talk about a county in, I think it's North Carolina, close to Raleigh, Wilson County. And you look at particularly a period, I think it was back in the 1970s, when it was kind of a cesspool of one misdeed after another, perpetrated by various levels of the criminal justice system. A place with, in your words, illegality in nearly every form imaginable. It's really a frightening picture, and of course Wilson County was not unique, but it's probably an especially graphic example of what can happen when this kind of culture is in place. Just briefly describe to our listeners what you describe in your book.
Yeah, well, you know, Wilson County in the 1970s was located right along what became I-95, but at that point it was simply a country road that led from Florida up to New York, and it became the main route of drugs and stolen cigarettes and all kinds of illegality, prostitution from, you know, truckers stopping. And so Wilson County was right in the middle of it, and the sheriff's department was a cesspool, frankly, of corruption back in those days. The federal government ended up prosecuting the sheriff and convicted him of operating a racketeer-influenced and corrupt organization through the sheriff's department, if you can believe that. So that's what existed in Wilson County back in the day. And Charles Ray Finch was a young man who was charged with a murder, I'm convinced, was committed by someone who knew about that corruption. But the police protected that person because he knew about the corruption and could blow the whistle on them. And so Charles Ray Finch, in my judgment, was literally framed for that murder in order to protect the police themselves. It's one of the few cases that I've run across where I honestly believe someone was intentionally framed, knowing that they were innocent, in order to protect the police. Charles Ray Finch ended up doing 42 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. He was eventually exonerated. The governor of North Carolina in June granted him a full pardon of innocence, recognizing that he had been wrongfully convicted and incarcerated for 42 years. And Charles Ray Finch died yesterday, having never really enjoyed life as he should have. The lesson there is that corruption spreads its tentacles throughout the criminal justice system, and the result can be just devastating.
Right, and especially when it is present in various layers of the criminal justice system. And I mean, that's when it becomes, in a sense, kind of a closed circuit of corrupt energy, and is especially frightening. I think a very striking portion of the book is in the 14th chapter, when you describe a case in which you were defending somebody by the name of Wilbur Hobby, and you yourself became, in a sense, kind of a target. I'm sorry, the 13th chapter, caught in the crossfire. You ended up being a target yourself in a way that was really frightening, especially for someone who at the time was a relatively young attorney with at a sort of fragile point in your own professional career. And I think the way you describe this really gave you some insight in terms of what it must feel like for somebody to be unfairly targeted. and wrongfully accused. Describe to our listeners what you experienced and what you learned from being, in a sense, on the other end of the equation.
Yeah, no, I very much, and my co-counsel very much became targets. United States attorney who was bound and determined to convict Wilbur Hobby, who was a very liberal labor leader in North Carolina in the 1960s and 70s, head of the North Carolina AFL-CIO. He had been indicted and prosecuted. It was a Republican U.S. attorney who had been a chief legislative aide to Senator Helms. And they were out to get Wilbur. And at some point, we had provided Wilbur with some of the grand jury transcripts to help us prepare to cross-examine witnesses. And all of a sudden, we found ourselves accused of violating sections of the regulations on grand jury materials, which could have resulted in our prosecution. And clearly, what was going on was an attempt to intimidate us and really to disqualify us from representing Wilbur. It got to the point where we hired Earl Silbert, who is a very prominent Washington lawyer. We hired a prominent North Carolina lawyer. It cost us a fair amount of money and untold anxiety at that point. And finally, you know, the judge called the prosecutor into his chambers. I said, okay, guys, either you're going to prosecute Rudolph and his partner, or you're going to prosecute Hobby. So go make up your minds and let me know, because we're going to do one or the other. We're not going to do both. And they backed off. But I understood in a really graphic and personal way what it feels like, because we hadn't done anything wrong. We had an absolute right to give Wilbur those transcripts. Absolute right. Absolutely clear. But yet being threatened with that and sitting there and listening to a federal judge say, okay, either prosecute Hobby or prosecute Rudolph, was chilling. And it created enormous anxiety in me. But more importantly, it created an understanding, an empathy for what my client go through. And it was early on in my career, and I never forgot that. And I think it was an important, although painful, lesson for me in what I do and why I do it.
Hmm. Your book explores many of the specific ways in which kind of the miscarriage of justice can play out, from the coercion of confessions to the way criminal or suspect lineups are arranged and all kinds of other ways at all levels of the criminal justice system. At one point you say, in our criminal justice system, the interest in finality, of being done with a case, generally overwhelms the interest in achieving justice. You're speaking to a really human attitude that I think a lot of us, probably all of us at certain points in time, have felt ourselves. How do we combat that? How do we come to terms with that reality?
Well, the way to come to terms with that, although I don't think we want to come to terms with it, I think what we ought to be doing is recognizing that the highest aim of what our criminal justice system is designed to achieve is justice and truth, not finality. Finality is an important component of the criminal justice system. No one can argue that. At the end of the day, innocence should trump finality. And right now in our system, it does not. The fact that you can prove somebody was innocent does not give you grounds, believe it or not, to vacate their conviction. You have to find some procedural impropriety in order to undo the conviction. Merely establishing that they got it wrong the first time is not enough. And that is inexcusable in my view.
Hmm. The book, once again, is titled American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System, published by Custom House, the author, David S. Rudolph. David S. Rudolph, thank you so much for the good work that you do, and thank you for sharing with the world this important book. Best wishes to you.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it greatly.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program features a memorable interview from the Morning Show archives, recorded and initially broadcast back in 2004. I have the great pleasure over the next few minutes of speaking with Daniel Lenihan and Gene Hackman, the co-authors of a superb novel called Justice for None, which takes us to the heart of the difficult lives of two men in particular, but in particular, someone named Boyd Calvin, who has seen such heartache in his life and yet emerged from it somehow, only to be plunged into still more difficulty and heartache, and then into the heart of the criminal justice system. And it is a wonderfully crafted work, and it is the second novel which has been written by our two guests, Daniel Lenihan and Gene Hackman. And yes, we're talking about the Gene Hackman. And gentlemen, we welcome both of you to the Morning Show.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right,
very much.
Great to be here.
I am much more a reader of nonfiction than fiction, but it is my impression that writing fiction collaboratively, as you do, is not especially common. Give us some sense of how the two of you work together as co-authors.
Well, we never actually sit down and write together. That's the common misconception of what we do. We meet a lot, and we discuss characters and storyline in depth. We then go off and we'll write, each one of us write three or four pages. We'll have another meeting. We will discuss that. And in the early part of the process, we probably meet a great deal. And then as we get further along and we know the characters, we know the storyline more solidly, we then could go off and do a chapter, 12 pages or something like that, and have the confidence that it's going to be of the same voice that the other writer is doing.
Wow. So when it comes to writing in sort of a final finished form, you are each, in a sense, kind of working independently of each other, and it all comes together as a whole.
Yes.
That's right. And I think one of the things that we've learned over the years, particularly with the second novel, is to each one of us has adopted a point of view of one character, and in it, and so when we use that process that way, it seems to let us converge the kind of creative energies we both have into seeing the story through the eyes of a different person. That works well in a collaboration.
Very good. You are each very different from the other in terms of life experience, and I presume what you bring to the table. From each of you, tell us what it is that you bring to this kind of effort in terms of, I don't know, perspective, experience, that kind of thing.
Oh, I think life experiences is probably the most important thing that we bring to the table. Dan and I have had certainly totally different backgrounds over the last, 40 years or whatever. But because we've had some similar life experiences, I think we're able to put those things down on paper. And I think that's very important, that we fictionalize many things that actually have happened to us. We broaden the idea, maybe dramatize it a little more than it really was when it happened. That kind of thing, I think, has been invaluable for us.
Yeah, it's actually a very interesting question. I think we've heard it posed before, and I think I agree with everything Gene said. Also, as different as our experiences have been, maybe there are some parallels, and that we both had in the early years, particularly, a fair amount of upheaval and conflict and life, and you know, maybe that comes out is one common ground for then the experiences that were different that we can bring back to, you know, to join at the root. I don't know. It's a good question.
This novel is set in a small town in the heart of Illinois, Vermilion, Illinois, 1929. That intersects, at least in one fairly direct way, with your life, Mr. Hackman. Tell us how you envision Vermilion to be similar or dissimilar to your hometown of Danville.
Well, it actually is Danville, and we changed the name just because there are some events that take place in the book that we didn't want to get in trouble over, and maybe to protect the innocent. The town itself is a wonderful town. I really enjoyed and feel privileged to have grown up in a small town like that, because I think there's a lot of values that I got from that I may not have gotten having been brought up where Dan was in New York. Dan and I spent similar years in New York, but we never knew each other in those days, of course. But I think my background from Illinois, growing up in that small town, was very helpful in constructing this novel.
Now, Mr. Lenihan, it says here you're an underwater archaeologist, and you write for Natural History magazine. Does any of that experience and expertise come to bear here? I can't think of any real direct way in which it does in the pages of this novel.
No, I suppose in the first novel that we did, Wake of the Perdido Star, there was some direct application, but not really. I think the only things that the things I would bring to it would be experience with being responsible for others in pretty difficult or life-threatening situations, you know, supervising diving operations for 30 years.
This, in many ways, at the heart and soul of this book is a friendship between a white man and a black man, between Boyd Calvin and George when they are imprisoned together. And that the dimensions of that and the complexity of that, I think, is beautifully drawn, as though you have experienced something of that yourselves one way or another.
Well, Dan had much more experience than I have with in civil rights in the 60s. I was, you know, somewhat selfish in those years, trying to make a living in New York doing odds and ends, and was not as aware of the situation as maybe Dan was.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that we both developed, I think, just a sensitivity toward those issues. You know, we can't certainly understand the experience of an African-American man in the deepest sense, because that's something only they can experience. But I think when we convey in the book that relationship, it's because it's a compelling one in the whole American experience, kind of. We've been able to experience it from one end, from the being the white guy in the process. But I think in the book, a feeling for the injustice and for the, you know, just the general conflicts that arise in that part of life I think they come out in a reasonable way.
The central character, Boyd Calvin, is a veteran from World War I, and very much haunted by his experience on the battlefield, and one experience in particular that is particularly terrible for him. What are the ways in which... what equipped you to write so beautifully about that experience of being haunted by something in one's past? You really have written about this so very realistically and sensitively, I think.
Well, I think some of that comes from maybe my technique as an actor, where you take an event that happened, some maybe an emotional event that happened in your life, and you transfer it to a script or a theater piece. And I think that's kind of what you're referring to is I certainly didn't have that experience of being gassed or being involved in the First World War, but I think one can do this transference and ask yourself the question, what if? How would I react if such and such happened? And it's the kind of questions we ask ourselves as actors.
Mm. Well, and I think one thing that I especially like about your book and this character, Boyd Calvin, is the fact that he is so marked and scarred, and yet in some ways still triumphant, in a way that, of course, not everybody is. Some people never do quite emerge from the shadows, or they allow the shadows to engulf them in really terrible and destructive ways. You've constructed a character that has this in his past and cannot leave it behind him, and yet manages to live life somehow.
Yeah, I guess it's the definition of a hero in a novel is that the person doesn't necessarily have to do a heroic act, but must act always as a human being and as a decent person.
Hmm.
Incidentally, before I forget it, I'd like to thank you for reading the novel.
Yeah,
we have so many interviews that where nobody has read the novel and becomes this kind of treatise on the movies.
Permit me one question that kind of touches on the movies. I wonder, particularly you, Mr. Hackman, as you write for the pages of a novel, do you find it tempting to write cinematically, or I mean, to somehow create visual images that belong on a screen? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean, and it is tempting. But, you know, I've been reading scripts for 50 years, and it's very difficult to get out of that mindset. I make a determined effort, and I think Dan would agree with this. We've talked about this, you know.
Yeah.
That I make a real effort to try not to write this for a film. If it becomes a film, that's great, that's fine.
Yeah.
But I try to always write in terms of thinking in terms of literature.
Hmm.
Yeah, I can. That's something I can vouch for. Working with Gene all the time, it's a real important thing to him. You know, I think it's not that screenplays aren't a real art in themselves. We've done a couple, and we think. We respect it. It's just that in a novel, Gene is very intent on there being multidimensionality to the characters, which is harder to do in the writing part of a screenplay, a movie. I don't mean that the actor can't give that dimensionality, but you know, it's difficult. I think that comes through a lot in the way he deals with his writing.
Well, I hope there will be more books from the two of you. And again, this one is called Justice for Nuns, published by St. Martin's Press. Daniel Lenihan and Gene Hackman, I congratulate you on a fine, fine novel, which I very much enjoyed reading, and I enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you so much for the thought for one of you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I hope that you will be able to join me for a program conceived with Holocaust Remembrance Day in mind. I speak with Minna Miller, who is artistic director of a Seattle-based group called Music of Remembrance, which seeks to commemorate the Holocaust and its victims through music. That will be tomorrow on The Morning Show, just after 8 o'clock.
Support for WGTD comes from the Nor-A Hair District, reminding you that many traffic accidents are a result of drivers on their cell phones. Whether you're talking or texting, cell phone usage while driving has become a serious problem. Nor A Hair District is located at 1947 Martin Luther King Drive in Milwaukee, 414-455-3007.